Good morning. We're drinking, so you should be too. Today our talk is, like you said, we got the two-hour block, so it's really kind of two separate talks here. I'm going to be spend about 50 minutes talking, and then Render's going to do his presentation. So I want to talk a little bit about how this talk came about. Last year at DEF CON, Renderman gave a talk called 10 Things That Are Pissing Me Off. And one of the things that he mentioned was as hackers, do we have the skills that are necessary in case something happens, like a disaster or some kind of society rebooting event, I think is what he uses. And so he did that, and I was also in the midst of watching like three seasons of Survivor Man, which is like one of my favorite shows. And I was also kind of doing some research on that. And back in January on the DEF CON forums, there was a thread that got started about, you know, hacker skills and, you know, kind of these disaster survival situations. So we kind of independently came to some different about the same conclusions we were both working on. So we said, hey, let's you know, put this together and make a talk for DEF CON. And here we are. So this is kind of the premise of our talk, and I hope by the end of the talk that you would agree with this. The first part is, you know, we already look at devices, and the first thing we think about is how can we break it and do something different with it, right? I mean, that's what we do. So the problem is we are tied to our electronics, we're tied to our high-speed internet, and when that gets shut off, we're like, oh, no, what do we do now? So, but we find that, you know, even then, even those circumstances, if you apply that hacker ingenuity to circumstances other than technology and computers, you can really use that hacker ingenuity to come up with, you know, extraordinary solutions. So the premise is, you know, your hacker skills, and we're not talking about things you learn, but things that are, you know, wired into your brain as a hacker, are really largely compatible with the skills that you need to survive in some sort of disaster or, you know, zombie situation, which Render will talk about when we get to the second part. So this is part one, and this is hacker skills for wilderness survival. And this is, we really have two parts here. So my part is about kind of more short-term, immediate survival situation in the midst of a disaster or... lots of people go for day hikes. Thousands of people get lost every year on day hikes and find themselves in some sort of emergency situation. Or what happens if the power goes out for more than 3 or 4 hours? Or what happens if you need to leave your house in 5 minutes because of a disaster? And what are you going to bring along? And the instant that that thing happens is too late to start thinking about what you need to do. So this is kind of the short-term situation. So a show called Survivor. How many people have seen the show Survivor Man? Awesome. Les Stroud's a Canadian, Canadian, who goes to kind of remote areas and does all sorts of, you know, crazy. I mean, he's like pretty much the ultimate hacker in terms of what he does. But he takes very little supplies along. He has no camera crew. He takes all the cameras himself. You know, so it's actually sort of almost a realistic, you know, reality show. One of the things that he always does, and you see this on the show, and you don't often think about it, is he'll have a camera set up at the top of a hill or a mountain, and you'll see him walking all the way up the hill, and you wait a second, how'd that camera get there? Then you see the making of show, and you realize that he had to walk all the way up, set up the camera, walk all the way back down, set up the and then walk back. So this is. This is my tribute to Survivor Man. This is the first trip I took up to Pennsylvania, and I'll show a little bit more video of it. This is simply me just driving up, and it's very kind of anticlimactic video, but this is my, hey, how'd the camera get there video as I arrived at the place where I was going. And I'll get more into this later when we talk about that, but that's my short tribute. So who am I? I work for Booz Allen in Central Maryland. I spent 8.5 years in the Navy as an electronic communications officer, EA-6B Prowler. I've done some combat missions over Afghanistan and Iraq. I spent 9 months on the ground in Iraq as a counter-IED specialist. And licensed amateur radio operator, active within the Church of Wi-Fi. I'm a football coach, and somewhere in there I find time to take care of 4 kids with my wife. So, and we'll get back to that too, because that's kind of important. This is my look at me slide. I contributed to all these books, so this is kind of cool. I spoke at DEF CON before 2 years ago on hacking Iraq and the counter ID, a talk, as well as ShmooCon and Hope and some other places. So that's me. So why should you listen to me at all? You know, people get up here all the time at DEF CON and they talk about, you know, really cool things. So this is kind of my why should you listen to me, maybe. Well, I was in the military 8.5 years. I did some really cool things. I had a lot of cool training. I graduated from SEER, which is Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, which is a capture, a POW-type course that the DOD gives. I'm sure some of you have probably done that as well. I have some other survival and outdoor training, and I've learned quite a bit from experience, actually going out and doing things. You know, I've read a lot of books, too, but I didn't put that up there because reading books to me in terms of doing this stuff doesn't really count. And the reason I say that is one of our good friends, Lost, if you go to Lost and you ask him how to do something, the first thing that he's going to come back to you with is a question. He's going to say, well, have you done it yourself or have you tried it? Last year at the Wireless Village, we came up with a slogan called Learn, Touch, Do. And that's really that has really kind of, you know, spread to now the lockpicking village and the hardware hacking village. And it's great to read about this stuff, but you actually have to do it if you want to learn how to do it. So that's kind of, you know, where we're going from here. If you want to learn this stuff, you got to do it yourself. So maybe why shouldn't you listen to me? Well, I'm not these guys. This is the picture on the left is Les Stroud, Survivor Man. The picture on the right is Bear Grylls. These are the guys that have the shows on TV, Survivor Man, Man vs. Wild. This is not me, okay? I don't have years of experience doing all this stuff. I'm not a survival expert. There are probably people out here who have better survival skills than me. I will readily admit that right off the bat. Some of you probably know more than I do. So, you know, take that into account. And also, your survival skills are going to be dependent upon a lot of different things. What sort of experience you have, where you're at, the weather, the time of the day. I took a couple trips that I'll talk about in a little bit, and you can see that the situations were a little bit different depending upon the location. So the skills that you need could be different upon the location. Okay, so why should you care about any of this? You know, why should we care about what could happen? Well, there's a couple things that I think are useful to know. Tornadoes, there's a lot of them every year. And they don't just take place in Tornado Alley. I think last year, 45 of the 50 states had tornadoes in them at some time. Yeah, most of the time, they're probably just, you know, the level one tornadoes. They don't really cause a lot of problems. But there are a lot of damaging tornadoes out there. And they actually cause a lot of damage every year. Hurricanes. There's 10 named hurricanes. Is that what it says? Yeah. 10 named hurricanes in the Atlantic every year since 1944 on average. So you can pretty much expect that, you know, whether it's a lull or whatever, you can expect that those. So if you live in the Gulf Coast or along the Atlantic coast, Atlantic seaboard, you know, that could be a problem for you. So $1.6 to $6.2 billion a year worth of damage. So that's a lot of damage, and some of it could happen to you. Hurricane Katrina and Rita, $45 billion in damage between the two. So, you know, that's kind of the anti-stimulus package. But, I mean, if you're in the midst of that, you know, what are you going to do? You know, the night before the hurricane comes bearing down on the coast, again, is not the time to start thinking about what you want to do. Get this back up. Okay, well, there's more. Natural disasters. There are roughly 19 magnitude 7.0 earthquakes every year. Okay, so if you live along the rim of fire, if you live along areas that are susceptible to tsunamis, these things happen. They could happen in your backyard. $4 billion in damage a year. I think this next one, you know, could possibly be a little overhyped, but I'll talk about it anyway. H1N1 virus, or the swine flu, or whatever you want to call it. Kind of slipped out of the news recently, but these are the latest statistics. 43,000 cases in the U.S. with 302 deaths, and 134,000 cases and 816 deaths worldwide. And actually, these numbers are probably low because the CDC is not reporting actual numbers anymore, and the World Health Organization is not requiring countries to actually submit numbers anymore. So these are probably the last, you know, decent, somewhat accurate numbers that we'll get. And there's a bunch of countries where it's, you know, it's increasing. I think, you know, they're having, especially in the UK and some countries in South America, they're, you know, increasing significantly lately. So in 2008, there were 9 weather events that caused damages exceeding $1 billion, 256 deaths. So, you know, there are problems out there that could affect you. That's really the point of this. So why you should care? Well, this is the Spanish flu of 1918. And what this chart shows is the death rate. And this is actually over a period of about a year and a half. And what it should show you is that the there's actually 3 waves to this swine flu, or to this 1918 Spanish flu. There was a wave where the death rate was, you know, fairly low. Then there was another wave where it was incredibly mortal. And then there was a third wave, actually. The other thing to gather from this chart is that these other flus, other than the normal flu, don't necessarily follow the flu season. You can actually get these things, you know, pretty much any time during the year. So they also, research have also found that the swine flu is fairly closely linked to the 1918 flu in terms of the normal flu just kind of gets into your respiratory tract, whereas these flus actually get down further into your lungs, cause more problems like pneumonia and such like that. The CDC actually put in an estimate about a week ago that said 40% of the people in the U.S. could get the swine flu over the next 3 years. I mean, so it's, you know, it's something to consider. Why else should you care? Well, large-scale problems and power outages. These are pictures you probably can't tell. This is the 2003 power outage, that cascading outage that occurred. You can see 1.21 gigawatts of power were lost to 50 million people. And then more recently, in January of this year, there was ice storms in Kentucky that caused a considerable amount of damage. Some people were without power for weeks. So there you go. Could you survive? Could you get along if you had no power for 2 or 3 weeks and you had no relatives or nowhere else to go? So, you know, you got to come up with something to do. So what's the bottom line? Well, these are reasons why people get into these problems. First of all, people underestimate how physically intensive it can be to survive outside of your home. Now, I'm one to talk because I certainly have a little extra weight. Thousands of people every year get lost on simple day hikes. You plan to go out for a couple hours. You're on a trail, you see something, you walk off to the side, you turn around, you're not on the trail anymore, and you don't know how to get back. And you don't have enough water, and you don't have enough food, and now what do? Well, it happens to thousands of people every year. And they often don't have maps. We're just going to take a short walk on a trail. We don't need a map. We don't need a GPS. We don't need any of this cool stuff. And you get lost. Many people are unprepared to live without power for more than a few hours. Your UPSs aren't going to last that long. So, you know, what are you going to do when everything shuts off and there's no light and you've got a screaming baby and kids running around or someone who's elderly or a pet? These are the things you need to think about. And I've said this before, the time when something bad happens is too late to start thinking about preparing. So this is what I did, and I caveat what I did is I took my then 17-year-old son along because I'm not going to go out there alone. I'm not an expert. I'm not going to go out alone and, you know, subject myself to the wilderness without having some sort of backup. So I traveled to, you know, what I would consider reasonably remote areas, you know, and I say that in quotes because it's kind of hard, you know, to drive within a few hours of Maryland to get to remote areas. But I took about 1 day supply of food and water, no shelter, and I did take a crappy video camera, and very limited other supplies. So what I attempted to do was try to at least demonstrate some of these techniques, you know, out in the wild with what we had, just to kind of show you that, you know, yeah, we all know that you can do certain things, but unless you get out there and do it, do you really know how to do it? And can you start a stick with, or can you start a fire by rubbing 2 sticks together? Well, yeah, you can, but it's really damn hard. The idea here goes back to what Stephen Levy said was the hands-on imperative, and this is getting your hands on things and actually doing something with it. Like I said, everybody knows that you can start a fire by rubbing 2 sticks together, but it's really hard to do. So the first place I went was to the Appalachians in south central Pennsylvania. This was on December 21st, 22nd, 2008, and don't ask me why I chose the day with the least amount of sunlight in the world. These are the kind of the challenges that were associated with that trip. Well, first of all, there was very little daylight. Obviously, you know, it was sunset at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It was below freezing. It was about 23 degrees, so not too cold, but, you know, still in the area where you could definitely get hypothermia or frostbite or something like that. There was snow and ice on the ground, so that was nice. All the wood was waterlogged, so start thinking about, and we got to start a fire, but everything is absolutely soaked or frozen. And we had no shelter. Cool. On a side note, it's very difficult to get to a place where you want to, where you can start a fire, but you're not in a prepared campsite. So we found a somewhat prepared campsite, and then we just kind of walked off from there into an area. I'd prefer to be a somewhere where no one has ever been, but it's almost impossible to do these days. So again, why did I choose December 21st? I don't know. It was actually kind of a whim, and I didn't really think about it until I was out there. So that's the preparation point. The second place I went was Assateague Island National Seashore in Maryland. And this is actually, it was a really cool one. I did this back in April. The challenges associated with this one, well, the site that we picked, it was a really long way to get to. And you had to walk over the beach. And if you walk in sand for a long time, it gets really difficult. There's really no protection from the wind. We were on the bay side of the island, but there's still a considerable amount of wind, and there's not a lot of trees to protect you from that. So the forecast was like overcast, and it rained all the time. And again, like I said, we had no shelter, so you are out in the rain all the time. So unfortunately, I did not get very much video from this trip, but I did get one clip that I'll show a little bit later. And now we get back to wood again. Waterlogged wood. There's lots of wood around, but it's all soaking wet. So you want to start a fire. Great. And again, no shelter. Well, there's a picnic table out there, which we ended up using for a little bit. But, you know, there's nothing else out there. And it's raining, and it's windy, and it's cold. So this is actually the one clip that I got from Assateague Island. And, yeah. If you're unfamiliar with Assateague Island, there's a huge herd of feral horses that are out there, and they're all over the place, and it's actually kind of cool because they'll just walk right up to you, but it's actually pretty cool. So this is my really one only video that I got from there. It doesn't show it, but it's absolutely raining the whole time we're there. It's a miserable trip, but we learned a lot of stuff, and that's kind of the point of that. So there's your oh my god ponies moment. So for the next section of the talk, I want to talk about what survival experts would generally consider your five, you know, basic survival skills. These are the skills that you need to know if you want to survive. And we will go into them individually. So here's your trivia question. Which one of these is most important? Any answers?
Beer.
Water, maybe. Shelter. Beer? Well, this is my cop-out answer. Honestly, it really depends. If you're in an area where you got a lot of fresh water, good to go on water. You don't have to worry about it. If you are in the Arctic, well, you know, water might not be an issue, but, you know, shelter might be more important. So it really does depend. What I want to do is walk you through each five of these, kind of talk a little bit about what you can do as a hacker to kind of acquire these skills and use your hacker ingenuity. So the first one is fire. I know you probably can't read these quotes, so I'll read them to you. This says, this was a quote that actually ended up on the DEF CON forums thread. This is from Penn Jillette from the End of the World episode of Bullshit. He says, What disaster makes it so that guns and matches don't work? If you want to survive, buy a case of ammo and some waterproof matches. And this was posted by one of my good friends, Deviant, in this thread. And he was like, well, you know, why is it that we always have to find these, you know, unique ways to start fires when we could just have matches? I mean, they should still work, right? Well, I would argue that starting fire there's kind of a scale of starting fires. I mean, everybody can start a fire with a match. I sure hope so, right? Or a lighter. You know, we can all do that. So you don't need to practice that. If you want to practice survival skills, you need to work on other methods of starting fires. Like I said, go outside and pick up two sticks and try to start a fire, and good luck. I don't think that was supposed to happen. Okay. So what's important about a fire? Well, warmth is really nice if it's cold out. It provides light, and there's something about a fire that gives you some sort of comfort in an area. It kind of takes away all the sounds in the background, all the creepies that are out there, and it kind of gives you the sense of like, well, at least I'm around a fire. I feel a little bit safer. And you shouldn't discount the psychological value of that. There is something to be said for that. So obviously there's benefits to that. It allows you for cooking, boiling water. Matches and lighters are okay, but what if they're in a bag that you dropped and it's soaked and you don't have those available to you anymore? Or what happens when you run out of matches? Like I said, starting a fire with two sticks, it's called a bow drill. If you haven't practiced it, it's not worth your time. You're not going to do it. I have a couple items up here that I want to at least show you. Some other options that are available to you. Let's see here. How do we do this? The first thing I want to show you is what's called a fire stick. This is a strip of cardboard that is dipped in wax, and then it's kind of like a candle. But the cool thing about this is that this thing will burn for about 10 or 15 minutes, and it gives you a bigger flame than a candle would, so you can kind of set this underneath your fire when you have a wet fire or wet materials, and this will help to kind of help you get that fire started a little bit faster because it kind of keeps that constant flame. These that I built, and they're tied with twine, these will run 15, 20 minutes. How many people, this is pretty obvious, how many people know you can start a fire with steel, wool, and batteries? Pretty much everybody. Okay, now keep your hands up. Keep your hands up. How many people have actually done it? Keep your hand up. Everybody put their hands down. Okay, so Sue, how many people know what kind of steel wool you need to use to start a fire? A few. Okay, so you go underneath your sink and you get the Brillo pad out. No, not going to happen. Those things are covered in soap, and the steel wool is actually very thick, and you won't get the necessary friction to go through the steel wool. You actually need what's called quad zero steel wool, which is kind of looks like this, and it probably looks like everything else. And you can do this with a AA battery, or you can do this with like two AA batteries, or you can do it with a 9-volt or something like that. And I will try not to set the stage on fire. Okay, I'm just pulling a piece off. Probably didn't pull a big enough piece off. So basically, I'm just putting these batteries end to end, and attach the steel wool, and hopefully, well, it's smoking up here, so that's kind of good. But the batteries are getting hot. I'm not going to go any further, but it is smoking up here, and the batteries are getting hot. So you can actually do it. It's kind of cool. But again, something you should ought to practice. Like I said, if you just take the Brillo pad out of your camping pack and think you're going to start a fire with it, it's not going to happen. You can come back now, Render. It's not. There's another cool thing, dryer lint. I know y'all got dryers and you have like, it's all stacked up on your dryer. You got this other, this stuff is great for starting fires. This stuff will light right up. And I don't ask me why I have a bag with me, but I do. Strangely enough, the TSA didn't seem to care that I had all the stuff in my bag. Then nobody questioned it.
Think about all the other crap that you have.
It was in my carry-on, too, so. Just a quick side note about being on an airplane. So I have this little case that I put my thumb drives in, and I have a USB switchblade in here, which is not new, but it's kind of, you know. So it's not a good idea when you're on the plane and you go to your friends and go, "Hey, I got a switchblade," and go like this. The guy behind me like stared me down the entire flight. I'm pretty sure he was ready to like bum rush me if I started going towards the cockpit. There's another thing which I have a video of. It's called Firesteel. And I have video, but I don't actually have a demonstration here. Firesteel is kind of a magnesium stick. It's about the size of a key. And you get a scraper, and you just scrape the stick, and it will just shower whatever your, you know, startup material is with sparks. This thing can be immersed in water. You pull it right out, and it works great. And this is actually one of my favorite ways of starting fires. So this is a video of – this is my son and I. My son is just putting a bunch of fire starting material here. All this material is kind of, it's dried grass, but it's actually wet. Everything's wet. And it's kind of hard to see, but it really only took me 2 scrapes of the fire steel, and that stuff just started right up. I had some dryer lint in there. And it took a while to get the fire, you know, going on its own. But we had one of these fire sticks underneath it, the candle type item that I showed you. And I know it's not as impressive as it looks, but there's snow and on the ground, everything's waterlogged, and it started right up. I mean, it was awesome. Yeah, did we have matches and a lighter and all that stuff? Sure, but again, that stuff's easy to do. Let's try the things that are a little bit more difficult. Shelter. The quote is, "Clothing is shelter in close proximity to the body," and that's really true. So it's very important what you wear. Because your clothing is your first layer of shelter. And if you don't have any external shelter, then that is your shelter. So shelter is designed to provide you some degree of protection from the outdoors or from the elements. And it does provide you some psychological comfort. So it's kind of important there. What you choose to build, well, that's highly dependent upon a whole bunch of things. It's going to be dependent upon the area, the location, the time of year, the weather, the other circumstances. All these things are going to, you know, determine what you use to build a shelter. So, you know, where do you want to build this thing? Well, the availability of water, avoiding water. You don't want to be on the bank of a stream when it overflows. That's not going to be fun. Protection from elements and proximity to other resources. All these things are going to weigh in your decision to choose a location to build a shelter. This is something that people have a problem with. When you have something that is, you know, kind of, you know, important to you, like a vehicle or, you know, things that are, people have a problem with destroying their precious items, even if it means helping you survive. Now, if you need to destroy something to help you survive, you should probably do it. The reason, and it sounds like common sense now, but there are people that don't do it. They won't realize that they have a lot of things available to them. If you got to, you know, if you got to cannibalize your vehicle to get, you know, items out of it that you need, well, you know, unless you are a zombie, you are going to die, and that's going to be the end of it. So, you know, you can get a new car. Also, keep in mind that when you're building a shelter, the things that you use to build a shelter are the perfect camouflage. So you're using trees, sticks, branches, leaves, etc. to build your shelter. And if you want somebody to come find you, being inside that shelter is probably not the best idea. Les Stroud said, yeah, he said, he used that quote, the shelter is the perfect camouflage. So kind of important to what you use to build it. Okay, so a little bit of video here. This is actually not our shelter. We took a tent out there on the first trip, but we didn't actually use it. We just took it, just kind of, this was our first trip. We're not really sure how this is going to work out. So we set it up, but we didn't actually use it. And this actually is our shelter. This is behind a fire. We kind of built a pseudo lean-to with everything. This is nothing that we brought along. This is all stuff that we brought or found out there. We found some twine. We found some branches. We just set them up, set up kind of a lean-to and put a bunch of logs on the roof. And the water was melting. It wasn't too close to the fire, but the water was melting considerably off the wood. So we figured about it was providing us about 10 to 15 degrees of additional protection from the outside. So not perfect, but if you can help you survive, then do it. If you're going to be out, if you know you're going to be out there for more than a night, then a lean-to may not be the best idea. You know, it's not too hard to just put something on the other side. Signaling. So the irony of survival is that for all the planning and preparation you do to stay alive in the wild, all you really want to do is go home. And this is from Les Stroud. So you're out there, you're in a survival situation or whatever you're doing, and things are not going well, but you're persevering, but really all you want to do is go home. So signaling is probably, you know, once you're there, it's probably one of the most important things. So this is once you've taken care of your immediate safety, signaling is probably something you want to take care of right away, and it's got to be ready at any time, because just a plane flying over, well, the first one, yeah, you might not be ready for that one, and they might not see it, and so you need to have a device, some sort of thing available. There's lots of survival signaling devices out there, mirrors, all sorts of things, flashlights, flares, chemicals. If you have an iPod, the back of it is really shiny. You know, that might be your mirror. Signal fires. The international signal, one of the international signals of distress is a triangle. So if you could somehow create three fires in a triangle or three anythings in a triangle, it's kind of an international signal of distress. Be alert for day versus night. If the plane flying over that you're trying to flash with your mirror is flying over at night, it's going to be a little difficult. There are personal locator beacons that are now available. This device up here is called a Spot Satellite Messenger, and this is kind of a device that you just take along with you, and it basically sends every time you can press an update, and it basically sends your GPS coordinates through a satellite. And then if you're on the other side, on the receiving side, you can get the GPS coordinates in Google Maps, and so you can get an idea of where the person is that you're following. And then there's a kind of a panic button which you push, and it'll actually alert the survival or the rescue authorities. These things are highly dependent upon a couple different things. If you're in have significant tree cover, the reviews are that they don't work really well. You need to be in an open area. And you actually need to be in an area where the rescue crews are reliable. In some countries, if they're not reliable, pressing this thing will notify them, but they probably won't come get you. And then there's a website called sendansos.com. I think it's a subscription site, but basically you can put your itinerary in there and say, I'm going to be back. This is where I'm going, and I'm going to be back at this time. And then if you don't get back within a certain amount of time, you can pre-configure, like, send messages to all these people that I didn't make it back in time. So it's, you know, maybe helpful. These are things you're going to have to, you know, consider on how you're going to go out there and what space you have and what sort of resources you have. But they are available to you. This is an article that I just pulled off the internet a couple weeks ago. This was a boy in Utah who got lost. And one of his he was a big fan of Man vs. Wild, and he actually used his rain poncho, which was like bright yellow, and was using that as signaling. He was leaving a trail of where he was going. So, you know, it was raining, so not smart to cut up his poncho, but somebody found him because of it. So, kid watching a TV show on TV that, you know, helped him survive. So that's kind of cool. There's also a number of stories out there for Survivor Man Les Stroud. People have watched that show and learned something and were out in a situation and, fought back to something he did on the show. And he's acknowledged that many times. I hate to call these shows reality shows because I honestly, reality shows are such a bad, connotation. To me, the only reality shows are like Cops, because it's actually like people being stupid. And Survivor Man, these are the only shows that are, to me, like almost reality. Okay. Food and water. An Arab proverb, it is wise to bring some water when one goes out to look for water. Huh, interesting. So, food and water. You can actually live maybe in excess of a month without food. It would suck. I've done it for a week and it sucked. But you can do it. In Seer, they don't give you food for a week, so that does suck. But you can only live maybe 2 to 3 days, maybe a little bit longer depending upon where you're at, without water. So in the food and water debate, water wins hands down. There's a bunch of environments that will drastically increase your need for water. Very hot, pretty obvious, right? Very cold. Very cold is what you don't think about. You need a lot of water when it's very cold. Very dry, kind of obvious. Windy. Wind will suck the moisture right out of you. Very important in a very windy environment to have access to a lot of water. But drinking all the water that's out there may not be a good thing. There's a nasty bug that's pretty much in all the water all over the U.S. It's called Giardia. Has anybody ever gotten Giardia? Probably a few people. Did it suck pretty bad? Yeah. This bug can stay in your system for weeks, 4 or 6 weeks sometimes, and it's really nasty. You could be in what you think is like the most pristine water location in the world, and you could get Giardia from it. Boiling water. Well, every time the power goes out, you get some message from the local authorities to say, boil water for 10 minutes, blah, blah, blah. It's actually, you don't actually have to do that. If you get to the point where the water is boiling, just when it's boiling, and then just shut it off, if you're in an environment where you don't have limited amount of fuel, boiling your water for 10 minutes is probably wasting a lot of fuel. Pasteurization process only takes milk up to about 161 degrees for about 10 to 15 seconds, and that works pretty good. If you get to the point where the water just starts to boil and then just shut off your power source, it will be above the temperature that needs to actually kill most of the stuff that's in the water. Here's a good one, and this is actually a considerable debate in the survival community: eating ice or snow. A lot of people will say don't do it because it'll lower your body temperature. Well, it really is dependent upon what you're doing. If you're about to go to bed, probably not a good idea to eat ice or snow. But if you're being active during the day, it may be something you consider. If you're in an environment where there's not a lot of water but there's ice and snow, during the day I would absolutely do it. Oh, yeah, we get to that one. Drinking your own urine. This is another one that is a little bit sketchy. Some people say, hey, if it helps you survive for an extra day, then do it. Urine is mostly water, but it does have the small percentage of really nasty stuff in it, and that's why it's urine. And if you keep drinking it, you're just keep polluting your body with that same high concentration of nasty stuff. So I'm not sure I could do this one, but you know, that's up to you. I don't have any videos of that. So Les Stroud says there's kind of a romantic myth, what he calls the myth of wild edibles. And this is the, you know what, if I don't have any food out there, I can eat off the land. And the reason he calls this a myth is because it's actually very difficult to accurately identify things out there that are edible that won't really mess you up. And they're very dependent upon you being able to correctly identify it. And if you haven't been out there with an expert to identify it, you might not be sure, and that's not the choice I want to take. Availability, depending upon where you're at, a lot of wild edibles are seasonal and very dependent upon the season or latitude. I would recommend, honestly, that you, unless you have been with an expert in the area where you are going, who has pointed out to you, this is the thing you can eat, this is the thing you want to avoid, I would probably stay away from wild edibles. Also, if your body's not used to them, you're going to have some problems associated with that as well. During SEER training, in the first couple days of SEER, they did this. They showed us all the different things you could eat. And, you know, I'm not going to describe the results, but it can be pretty nasty. There's a nasty factor to insects and bugs and critters, but they can actually be some of your best nutrition. Again, I don't have a video of that, but you've seen Fear Factor and all those. It seems like every episode people are eating nasty stuff. Unless you have a firearm or some sort of, you know, serious weapon, I would expect that large game, you don't have a chance. If you think you can, like, throw a rock and kill some large game, it's not going to happen. You probably ought to concentrate on small game, squirrels, rabbits, snares and traps. There's a large community of advice on building traps and snares and those sorts of devices. And numbers are your friend here. If you build one trap and you think that's going to work, it's probably not going to. But if you build 10 or 15 or 20, you might get a hit on one of them. Also consider that the more you eat, the more you need water. So we talked about how you can live without food. If you find, you know, if you're in an area where you don't have a lot of water, don't gorge yourself, even if you went on food. This video, I kind of lost the audio on it, but I found a pretty much pristine mountain stream. This is water coming out, literally coming out of the ground, and it's a fairly high point in the area where I was, so it's probably right from the water table. And I didn't get sick from it, which is good, but I advise that you really consider, be careful with this sort of thing. And even in this case, where the water is probably very clean, it doesn't have a lot of bugs in it, you probably still want to at least get it to the boiling point to kill anything that would be in it. I was fortunate enough to find literally the source of this water, and, but it's, you may not have that option, so. First aid. I only have one slide on this because I have some other things I want to talk about. But this is the first one, and this is the one you have to think about now. Do not panic. This is a generic first aid thing. Don't panic. The survival acronym for first aid is STOP, which is stop, think, observe, plan. If you can do that, you are going to be miles ahead of other people. First aid and CPR. I'm not going to belabor that. If you have the opportunity to do it, absolutely do it. As a football coach, we're all, pretty much all different jobs that you have to do. Sometimes you run across the opportunity to do it. It's so easy. They make it so easy. You might as well just do it. The last one is our four points on your body that are really important to take care of. And it may not seem obvious right off the bat, but they really are. Eyes, feet, hands, and stomach. If you can take care of these things, you have a great chance of surviving. Obviously, eyes are kind of important to seeing. Feet, which goes into wearing good fitting clothing, good fitting shoes, taking care. If your feet are messed up, you're going to have trouble moving. Your hands, obviously, to do things, and then your stomach. If your indigestive system is messed up, then you can be really messed up. Okay, last section I want to talk about is preparation. Let's see how we're on. 43, good. Seneca, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. Awesome. And very true, I might add. If you are expecting luck to be on your side and you haven't prepared, you lose. So here's my quote. Given the will to survive, thriving in the wild or in a disaster situation or in the wilderness is largely a matter of preparation combined with the hacker ingenuity to find creative solutions under extraordinary circumstances. And this is another on my list of the ultimate hackers. How many people are fans of MacGyver? Yeah, I thought so. It's not like a big surprise. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about preparation. Kits versus custom. There are a lot of survival kits out there that you can buy. They're pre-made. They come in a little box, and it gives you everything you want. Maybe good to as a start, but I would advise against these, and basically because they're not going to work with the situation you're in. You're going to come across something that you need, and it's not going to be in that survival kit because you're in a unique situation. Also, you have it in the kit, so you haven't practiced it and used it, and pulling it out on your survival situation to use it for the first time is not the best time to use it. So I recommend you may be able to use that as a starting point, but you really ought to customize your survival kit based on your location, your circumstances, etc. I'm going to talk a little bit about gear recommendations. I'm not endorsing the products. I don't get kickbacks. They're things that I've used and I found useful, so I just want to point that out. Talking about a little bit about home preparation, vehicle preparation, and then hiking and camping. There was a book called Mountaineering, Freedom of the Hills, put out a long time ago, a pamphlet book, and it's got recommendations about what to put in your kits. And then I'll talk about bug out bags. So these are recommendations. Under Armour makes a lot of cool products. The boxer briefs are pretty cool. I'm not going to show you them, but I am wearing them. I'm going to pass. let's go on. Your shoes ought to be comfortable. If you're going out on just a real short day hike and you want to wear like your flip-flops or your Crocs or whatever, yeah, not so good. You get bit by a bug or a snake or something, yeah. Boots, probably a good idea, and don't just buy them and go, you know, wear them around, get used to wearing them. Thorlo, and there's a whole bunch of companies that make socks out there that are for hiking, camping. They have some extra padding in. Highly recommended. There's a product called the Riggers Belt, which gives you lots of points to attach items to, which is really cool. And then there's this thing called the Recon Wrap, which I'll basically just a flexible piece of material here. It's just kind of a shaped in the shape of a tube, and the tubes. Basically, you can use this for a whole bunch of different things, but you can use it to keep dust out of your face. You can use it for filtering things. You can use it for keeping the sweat, and you know, basically, it's kind of this deal. Helmet liner, pretty much anything you want. These things are really cool. I used one of these in Iraq as a helmet liner, and they're really awesome. So these things cost about 15 or 20 bucks. You get them online, and they're awesome. Did I say they're awesome? Surefire or one of the flat, like really high power flashlights are really cool. This is one that I actually used attached to a weapon, but these things are really bright. I mean, even in a room that's lit up reasonably well, you can see these things are really, yeah. These things use 1-2-3 batteries, so they're, you know, a little bit expensive, and the Surefire flashlights are expensive, but these are also good as a personal defense type of thing. I mean, if obviously, you know, you guys are far away and I'm blinding you. If you shine one of these in someone's face, yeah. Moving along. Leatherman, multi-tool, highly recommended. There's all whole bunch of different brands. Find one that you like, or some sort of knife, or, you know. And then the fire steel thing. Those things are like $5 or $10, and they last forever. So that's my recommendations. Home preparation, just a couple items. Water. Bottled water, sure. Out of the tap, unless you're in a situation where your water supply is contaminated, sure. Filling up your bathtub, probably a good idea. People often, this was demonstrated by Les Stroud, people think about the toilet. The water in your toilet tank is not contaminated. Or at least, unless you have one of those tabs in there like that puts chlorine in there. If it's just water, it's water. It hasn't been through the toilet yet. You're good to go. Drink it. Also consider water for bathing. Food. Perishables, non-perishables, cookability, all things that are important in keeping your stuff together. Consider heat and how you're going to keep warm, signaling, communication, traveling, et cetera. In your vehicle, water plus food, fire starting capabilities, signaling devices. Back in 95 or so, I was in college up in Pennsylvania, and I went home for the weekend. It was Easter weekend, so it was like sometime in April. I went back the next day, and I got stuck on Interstate I-81, which got shut down when I was on the interstate. I had taken everything home. I had nothing in the car, and the interstate was shut down at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and not opened up till 5 o'clock the next morning. That was not fun, and I was totally not prepared because of, oh, I don't need my winter stuff anymore. It's fine. No problems. Sat on the interstate for a lot of hours, and it was not fun. Battery cables, other materials of space allow. It's not really hard to have a small kit in your car of stuff that you can use. Like I said before, don't hesitate to cannibalize your vehicle if you need it to survive because you can always buy a new car. You can't buy a new you. This is the 10 essentials. I'm not going to read through them. Like I said, there's a publication called Mountaineering, Freedom of the Hills, and these are the recommendations. These have been around for decades, so a lot of these things are, you know, will always be the same. They're always good to have. Experts also recommend that you add on to this depending upon what your circumstances are. Bug out bag. How many people have bug out bags or some variation of it? Well, there's some out there. Cool. That's awesome. Bug out bag is a survival kit in case you have to leave really quick, and it should generally have, you know, 72 hours worth of supplies. So you want to have water for, you know, at least a gallon of water per person for each day. Might be, that's, I mean, it takes up a lot of space. Non-perishable food, first aid kit. There's a lot of recommend supplies that you can put in there. I'm not going to go through them, but it's consider other things. You know, I have four kids at home. I have two kids under 3 years old. So in my preparation, I have to think about baby food. I have to think about diapers. I have to think about something for them to occupy their time with. If you have elderly that you're taking care of, you think of medication, all the things that they need. So it's there's circumstances that you have to think about. Don't just if you were just thinking about yourself, you know, you got to think about the people you're taking care of as well. Oh, also on that matter, one of my friends at work was looking for homes and was doing home shopping. And they went into the basement of some guy's house that they were going to buy from, that they were looking to buy from. And they had like a hole from basically floor to ceiling full of perishable foods, like survival stuff. And then they had like a bag for each person in the family with like their name on it. And I'm like, that's over. I mean, it seems like overkill, but that's like what everybody, the point that everybody wants to get to, so that you could just grab your bag and go if you wanted to, and that's pretty awesome. Final thoughts. Man can live with about 40 days without food, 3 days without water, 8 minutes without air, but only for 1 second without hope. Final thoughts. Don't be squeamish about breaking things or destroying things that you need to survive. You and I, we're not Jack Bauer, we're not MacGyver, we're not Survivor Man, we're not Bear Grylls. We can't do this stuff on our own unless we get out and practice it on a regular basis, so you should do that, and that's what why I'm doing this. Here's a quote from Les Stroud. He said, "Don't consider what it is, but what it could be." Now think about that. He's talking about a survival situation, but is that not absolutely what we think of as hackers? Take something and use it for what you need it for, not necessarily what it's intended for. This is totally the hands-on imperative. Your psychological strength together with your will to survive is the most important survival skill. So that's kind of the answer to the question that I didn't give you. Here's the cool things, places where I got research, CDC, NOAA, World Health Organization, Les Stroud book, Mountaineering, Freedom of the Hills. And lastly, I do want to thank my family. How many people in here are married and their spouse doesn't necessarily share the same, you know, hobbies and, yeah. So for those of you out there, you have incredibly patient spouses that put up with your projects that never get done and put up with all that extra stuff and put up with you coming to DEF CON and, yeah. So I do want to thank my wife and my family for letting me do this cool stuff. So I know we have the questions here, but we're not going to put questions. I'm going to put Renderman up, and then if we have time at the end, we will answer questions here, or we will go to, I think it's 104, one of the rooms down there, one of the, what are they called? Q&A rooms. Q&A rooms. Thank you. And that's it for me, and I'm going to hand it over to Renderman. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to get started here. I am Renderman. You've probably seen a lot of additional fedoras this year, but this is the one, the only, the original. So if you've, I am the guy that's been rocking the fedora for the last 11 DEF CONs. So. All right, so this is Hacking Disasters, basically looking beyond what the Prez was talking about. He was talking about short term. I started thinking long term. So congratulations, you survived the apocalypse. Now what? That's a good question. Basically, in 2008, I went to a conference in Oslo called HackCon. It's the first time I'd ever actually visited a country that had been occupied at any recent memory time. So, you know, Second World War, the Germans invaded and generally made things miserable for a couple of years. While we were there, we visited the Resistance Museum. Zach, Goon Zach, was with us, and at one point we were looking at a bunch of homemade radios. Can everybody hear me? Okay, good. We were looking at a bunch of homemade radios, and you know these guys were coming up with stuff that was just absolutely amazing, built into like shoes and you know crates and stuff like that. At one point he pulls out his phone and he says, you know, how many circuits are in this cell phone? How many transistors are in here? And it's like, I can see all of them in there that are in this one. You know, I can count them on, you know, two hands. And just made me start thinking, well, who could recreate this, you know? Around the museum, there was one photo that particularly stood out, and I do apologize for the quality. It's one of those photos that's made up entirely of dots of different sizes, so it doesn't photograph well. But basically, you have, that's the King's Palace right there in downtown Oslo, and a bunch of German soldiers marching down in 1940. This is from a block down. There's the King's residence. That's roughly where the German soldiers were when I was there. And it was this kind of epiphany moment of, holy crap, I'm standing where a bunch of German soldiers just were, you know, in the grand scheme of things, in a fairly short time ago. I started thinking more about this, and you look at the Norwegian resistance, and these guys are true hackers. These guys, under extreme circumstances, living off the grid and in the mountains, in the, you know, Scandinavian winters, hiding from a lethal roaming enemy, you know, they get caught, they get shot, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. They had to build everything, shelter, equipment, radios, you know, to fight back, communicate, coordinate. They were very, very effective. You compare that to your modern urban dweller, most of these people utterly fail to understand any device that they own. It's, you know, how many people still have relatives that have a VCR that still flashes 12? You know, hands are going up. You know the kind of person I mean. You know, how many of you have seen an executive or somebody, you know, during a BlackBerry outage, they're a whimpering pile of goo on the floor because they can't get their emails and they're freaking out? Nobody repairs anything anymore. I mean, with the exclusion of people in this room, but in general, there are so many people who it's like, oh, I'll just buy another one. It got me thinking, you know, what would I do in a case like the Norwegian resistance? You know, they get invaded. Suddenly you're dealing with this extreme circumstance that you really hadn't thought about before. And the answer kind of wasn't confidence boosting. I would be that whimpering pile of goo on the floor. I honestly, you know, can say I don't think I'd be very effective. Don't plug me. Looking at other people around me wasn't very helpful either. You know, there's a lot of people around that I don't think would be particularly useful either. Nope. You know, the idea just kind of bounced around the back of my head for a while, and then one day, you know, late at night, sitting there with a beer, watching Dawn of the Dead. You know. And you know, you start looking at this, and it's like in every zombie movie or apocalypse movie, you've got your motley crew of survivors. You know, you've got, you know, the blonde chick over here, the angry loner guy, and all the motley crew. And I'm like, where would I fit in this? The answer I came up with was, I'd be the guy that they would throw at the zombies to slow them down while everybody else made their escape. That's not the role that I want to be fulfilling. So I started thinking, how can I make myself more useful in such a circumstance that where others would protect me because I'm more useful, that I wouldn't be having to be the guy being sacrificed to slow everything down. Also got me thinking, how can you help shortcut the rebuilding? You know, should you survive that short term, you know, the initial problem, and you know you're going to be around for a while, how do you help shortcut the rebuilding? And also, can you do it without getting weird, you know, to be some guy sitting in a mountain cabin, you know, stroking his gun while sitting on a mountain of canned goods? I didn't want to end up like that. You know, there's already enough people like that out there. How can I do it without being weird and, you know, possibly end up with an interesting federal file? So basically started treating it as a hacker problem, you know, disaster and recovery on a planetary level. I mean, how many of you do disaster planning for, like, corporate IT systems and, you know, business continuity and stuff like that? A lot of the same things apply. What do you need to continue doing business? Well, what do you need to continue society in, you know, a very large grand sense? Hackerspaces also seem to me to be a very logical and natural learning and teaching ground for this stuff too. So it's not just the fact that we need to identify these skills, you need to teach other people so that, you know, in a disaster, you don't know who's going to survive. You need to make sure these skills are as widely distributed as possible. And a hackerspace seems to be a very sane and logical place to do this. I just want to point out that the question of what if is not a bad thing to ask. I mean, I was always hearing, it's like, well, why are you thinking about that? Why are you thinking about the end of the world? I'm like, why not? You know, if you don't ask the question, you can't formulate the answer. And having an answer to a question like that at the right time can be a pretty useful thing, I think you can understand. I was also motivated because at last year I ended up losing a massive amount of data. And just to go aside, Scott, stand up. Scott Moulton here bailed my ass out and managed to recover like 99% of this data. It's testament to what I'm going to talk about later that all the information that we have at our fingertips now in our modern world is very, very fragile. And, you know, you lose a terabyte hard drive, think about how much you've actually lost. You know, that's like how many Library of Congress is burning down. So, I mean, this guy just bailed me out, so I have to give mad props to Scott. So, thank you. So I started looking around and found, you know, all these urban survival classes and stuff like that, and pretty much all of them boiled down to, if you can pick locks, you'll be able to survive anything. That was the stupidest thing I had heard. Another side note, how many of you are familiar with the new Discovery show that came out like last week, The Colony? All right. This show caused me no end of grief because suddenly I'm up here looking like, you know, Me Too kind of guy, you know, AOLer here. This talk has been formulating for about the last year and a half. Great frequency, my wife can attest to it because I won't stop talking about this crap, and I'm sure she's glad that I'm finally giving it, so I'll stop talking about it. But these guys started production a while ago. They just started getting things out there. It's nice to see. The whole premise of the show is you've got a dozen survivors after a massive plague, you know, an apocalypse. They put them in this walled-off area of L.A., you know, in a factory, and, you know, they have to take care of their needs and everything like that, and it's thinking, you know, more after the disaster kind of stuff. It's nice to see there's attention being given to the topic. Problem is, it's a TV show. It's very controlled and contrived. You know, the situations are scripted. You can't really accurately represent the chaos of the end of the world. It's one of those things that until you're there, you don't know what is going to happen. One of the things they seem bent on doing is constantly sending in these marauders, you know, to try to raid the survivors and everything like that. And, well, first thing I do is kill the bastards. You can't do that on a TV show, though. So, you know, and also they have to make sure that, you know, oh, gee, these guys need to provide power. Oh, gee, there's this big pallet of batteries sitting there. And, oh, gee, all of them happen to be up, you know, 12 and a half, 13 volts. How wonderful is that? And, like, it's just so contrived. And, I mean, there's a camera guy standing right there, so you can only do so much. So it's nice to see attention, but I wouldn't look at that as more than just, you know, inspiration for your own kind of research. Speaking of disasters, large or small, they suck. The big ones really suck. I'm talking like massive, massive scale. Like, all right, you four up front, you survive. The rest of you are dead. You know, that kind of you know, wipe out 90% of things. It's kind of hard to practice for until you get there, and it's one of those things that, yeah, you don't get a lot of chance to reset that and try again. So you have to do it as a thought experiment. Are we ready to actually rebuild from scratch? You know, wipe out 99% of the people around you. You've got this motley crew of survivors you've seen all these movies. Could we actually pull off, you know, rebooting society, you know, starting over again, you know, rebuilding back to the modern level of technology and sophistication that we have now in any sort of reasonable time? I also looked at it as a way to improve myself. I wanted to know more of how to do things, you know, how to actually build my own equipment and everything like that. And it's been very illuminating as to the deficiencies that your average modern person has, that how much we don't actually know about our day-to-day lives, that, you know, you turn the tap, water comes out. You don't know everything that went into that, all the plumbing and everything like that. We are at this weird point where we're standing on nothing. Nobody knows how to do the stuff that everything we need is built on. it also gave me a really good excuse to watch like 200 hours worth of zombie movies and TV shows. And I'd never really gotten into the zombie movie thing before. And I got to say, there's a really interesting bathtub curve that occurs where if you've got a low budget, your quality is actually really high because they don't have to rely on the special effects and everything. They actually have to have a good story. But then, you know, at some point they're given a little bit more money and then the quality just sucks because, you know, they get some cheap special effects in there. And then you get, like, you know, Grindhouse and stuff like that and just gets really good. So, two I'm waiting for is World War Z and Zombieland. I really am waiting for those. I also welcome your thoughts afterwards in the Q&A room. Something I'm wanting to get is community going to work with the regular zombie guys to say, okay, stop thinking about short term, think long term. How do you survive, you know, months, years, decades with a persistent disaster? And how do you reboot society after a crash? Man, I repeat a lot in this thing. Not life ending, but damn close. Like I said, you know, you got four people in this room survive. They're wandering around a wasteland, which generally describes everything outside of Vegas. Everybody's always thinking about hurricanes, blizzards, floods, earthquakes, building kits specifically for that based on their region. I'm thinking stuff that could happen halfway around the world and not, you know, you can't, don't normally think to prepare for that. There's also low-intensity, high-impact disasters. That's where zombies come in later because it's one of those things that just, it persists and you don't know what, you know, it's always going to be there, so you now have to deal with this new reality. I started looking at pop culture for references because I wasn't finding anything good in, you know, your urban survival classes and that. And a lot of these people just in general scared me. They were the kind of nutters that I was not wanting to become. And I was trying to think for your everyman person, you know, what could they do? Two books, both fiction, that proved very useful were Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z. Both by Max Brooks, who is actually the son of Mel Brooks. They basically make the tacit agreement with the reader that, okay, zombies exist, so let's work with that as a thought experiment. And they're both very, very good reads, so I highly recommend those. This presentation isn't like a direct lift from them. It's a lot of my own content and everything. So, but it's the thought-provoking nature of it, particularly World War Z, because it asks that what-if question. And, you know, but goes to its logical conclusion. Usually everything stopped at the, okay, I've survived. Nothing about the now what. So, you know, I saw a definite need. Type 1 disasters are, you know, the ah, crap. Solar flares, grid fails, ice storms. Enough to overwhelm and disable rescue infrastructure so that, yeah, it's going to be a while before they can get to you. You know, the Quebec ice storms where people were locked in there, literally frozen in their houses for a week. They can be sorted out in time, but you're going to need to survive longer than, you know, that 72-hour kit that you've got. They're low intensity but far-reaching. A solar flare, basically it's what happens is your ground voltage goes to about positive 5,000 volts, which is anybody, you know, who does any sort of electronics is a bad thing. In 1989 in Quebec, a solar flare hit and basically was blown out circuit breakers and equipment left, right, and center. Imagine something like that hitting all of North America at once. Asia could not build enough replacement parts for all the little widgets and gadgets and plasma TVs and stuff that we all depend on nowadays. It would take them forever to build replacements on this. It'd be a tough period of building on your own. Of being on your own, and if you had something like this happen in winter, you know, because I'm from Canada, I'm used to the frozen north, there's a lot of people that I think would end up dying just because there's so much disaster around you that needs to be attended to as well. Grid failures. The national power grid for North America and basically for the rest of the world is an absolute mess. 1965, the Northeast blackout, a maintenance issue in the northeastern U.S., caused massive blackout. You know, everybody asks, you know, oh, where were you in the blackout of 65 and everything? And it, very little crime or looting. It was odd because everybody just kind of came outside and actually met their neighbors for once and, you know, learned something about them. This was weird. 1977, on the other hand, you have a massive crime spree, looting, arson, New York City just explodes. It was also during a hot summer heat wave and a heavily depressed economy. Oh, gee, what are we in right now? the blackout of 2003, which I'm sure everybody remembers. There was almost no crime. It was a strangely calm event. And I think after 9/11, everybody had, you know, enough of panic and they just sort of went numb. But will the next time the grid fails on a spectacular fashion, will people be that calm, or will you have absolute anarchy? Type 2 disasters are basically where you're standing there and it's like, I don't care where you are, you can say, we're boned. Small meteorite, small being a relative term, strategic earthquakes, stuff like that. Recovery is going to take years. It's the sort of thing that wipes out huge amounts of stuff. A small meteorite is something that, you know, makes a state like, you know, Rhode Island, which strangely becomes a unit of measurement a lot, makes Rhode Island suddenly go away. The impact of that would be profound, just because the amount of energy it would take to make Rhode Island go away. There's a few other states I like to make go away, but that's, you know, mostly because they keep throwing deer at me. I found a neat... I hit a deer in Utah at DEF CON, what was that, 10 or 11 or something like that, and sucky trip. But basically, there's if you go to this website, there's a Google Map mashup of the crater sizes that would occur after certain sized meteorites and everything. And yeah, you start looking at the blast radius and everything like that, and it's like, yes, it doesn't take much, you know, to get through that atmosphere. The effects will be felt through the world, but it's not the sort of thing that's going to be life-ending, but it will be drastically life-changing beyond, I think, what anybody can really predict. Then there's the strategic earthquake, meaning it's a naturally occurring earthquake, but Mother Nature basically doing a big fuck you. The island of La Palma, the Cumbrian Vieja, there's an island in the Canary Islands. It's splitting right down the middle. 500 square kilometers of rock. Basically, you know, an island is the top of a mountain, so that's 500 square kilometers that's poking out the top, plus everything going down to the ocean floor, is basically aimed straight at the U.S. East Coast. And if that lets go, the resulting tsunami, 30 to 60 meters high, going about 25 kilometers inland. Start thinking about the net effect of that. I mean, you look at what happened in, 2006, the tsunami in Southeast Asia there. I mean, that was wiping out a lot, and that was a comparatively small to this. And I mean, this is like literally that ticking time bomb scenario where this thing's sitting there just waiting to go. You know, could be today, could be tomorrow, we don't know. Mother Nature is a right bitch. She's got all sorts of things that we can't predict that are going to really suck. Then there's the Type 3 disasters, and yeah, this is basically your zombie attack. It's the worst you could possibly think of. No rescue, no outside support. You are on your own. Disaster that is constant, ongoing, and probably will never be contained or resolved, so you'll never be able to go back to the way things were. Hackers are very creative and smart people. If we could survive the short term by following the Prez's advice, how do we make ourselves useful in the long term? No knowledge is bad. Yeah, I think we could all agree on that. Knowing anything, there's no knowledge that one could say, oh, you shouldn't know that. I mean, there's a lot of things we'd like to unsee and, you know, need mind bleach, but knowledge of facts is not a bad thing. So I'm basically proposing that we be keepers of lost or knowledge that's about to be lost, because we have the ability to understand it, treat it well, pass it on, and it seems a little disjointed, but by the end, hopefully, I'll make you understand what's going on in my head. So hopefully, you have a better idea than what I do. Thank you, Google Images. Yeah. Planning and hoarding can only go so far. You need to educate yourself. because you don't know what is going to happen. You kind of need to prepare for everything and yet nothing at the same time. I am my own test subject. I plan on actually trying or am doing most of the things I'm going to talk about. It doesn't have to be make you weird. You know, as I said, you know, the guy sitting on a mountain of canned food stroking his gun. And I would encourage anybody else who is interested to keep in touch and let me know what you're doing and how it's going and to sort of see, okay, what does it actually take to become, you know, the hacker survivor man? And I'll read the comic in a minute if for those of you who can't see. I don't know if you've noticed, but we're rapidly forgetting how we got here. So many things we don't build straight from scratch anymore. We outsource it to the lowest bidder, which is usually some third world country that we don't know how it gets there. It's just a shiny box appears with a part or the material or whatever we need. You grab your average person off the streets of New York City, they're not going to know anything about where things come from. We've forgotten so very much. I mean, there used to be a time where people had to build everything they needed to survive out on, you know, the prairies and, you know, the wagon trains and everything. The people in this room, you know, they're probably saying, well, I'd be okay and, you know, everything. You know, I remember what my grandfather taught me and everything like that. But go forward 2-3 generations. How many of you have seen, you know, not to pick on anybody if they are this age, but, you know, some 14-year-old standing in line somewhere that has a complete inability to deal with not being in contact with somebody, that are just standing there and, you know, a few of you are raising hands, they're just standing there and they cannot actually deal with their own thoughts. Take away everything that they know, these people will be the most useless. You know, they're made entirely of meat. That's the only thing that they are. So. And I'll just read you the comic because unfortunately it's a little hard to see, but you know, the dad is talking to the daughter and he says, Daddy, are we going to get a zombie game? Mm-hmm. And what do we do with zombies? Aim for the head and don't get bit. And if I should get bitten and begin to turn, then I'll take you out myself. That's right, princess. The clerk goes, cutest kid ever. So. The basic building blocks of society don't exist anymore. We outsourced it. It's, you know, in Asia or whatever anymore. Classical scientists had to be polymaths. You know, these guys, if they wanted to do an experiment or something, they had to blow their own glass. They had to build their own equipment. It wasn't just, you know, run down to the store and grab such and such or anything. I mean, it's still the case where they have to build a lot, but there's just so much more that is being outsourced that we don't make it anymore. We just order it. You know. We're also highly integrated with, you know, the proverbial grid, you know, the telecommunications, the electricity, the supply chains, everything like that. Thousands and thousands of people are involved in every single product. And I've got a video that really puts it into perspective here. And there's also a lack of danger in our lives. Most people don't, you know, have the normal kinds of dangers that you used to have, you know, where you get eaten by a bear or something like that. So they had no reason. They have no reason anymore to learn some of these things that previously were very practical because you didn't want to be eaten by a bear. So I ask you to consider 2 things. Consider a pencil and a toaster. I hope this video works. Come on. How bloody overlays. All right. All else fails. Okay. I will play the video separately. I hope it plays. Oh, bite me. Oh, bloody hell. I did. Screw you, Ubuntu. I tested this just earlier. God, I don't know what the hell.
My videos worked fine in Windows.
Oh, Remind me to hurt you later. All right, let's just one more.
There you go. Is that coming through?
Well, I've got it on here now, so. Come on. Oh. Okay, well, we'll do it this way, I guess. Oh, damn, I didn't plug in audio.
Can we get it up?
That
is a headphone jack.
Ordered from South America by some businessmen with the help of the British government.
No, no, no. I got to restart it.
Look at this lead pencil. There's not a single person in the world who could make this pencil. Remarkable statement? Not at all. The wood from which it's made, for all I know, comes from a tree that was cut down in the state of Washington. To cut down that tree, it took a saw. To make the saw, it took steel. To make the steel, it took iron ore. This black center, we call it lead, but it's really graphite, compressed graphite. I'm not sure where it comes from, but I think it comes from some mines in South America. This red top up here, the eraser, bit of rubber, probably comes from Malaya, where the rubber tree isn't even native. It was imported from South America by some businessmen with the help of the British government. This brass ferrule, I haven't the slightest idea where it came from, or the yellow paint, or the paint that made the black lines, or the glue that holds it together. Literally thousands of people cooperated to make this pencil. People who don't speak the same language, who practice different religions, who might hate one another if they ever met. When you go down to the store and buy this pencil, you are in effect trading a few minutes of your time for a few seconds of the time of all those thousands of people.
Kind of thought-provoking, isn't it? Well, I'm not sure why it's off to the side there, but UK artist Thomas Thwaites attempted to build a $5 toaster. It's called the Toaster Project. And he wanted to build it from scratch in every sense of the word. Mine the ore, smelt it himself, everything. You know, this is normally what would cost $5 in a store. It was an absolute fail, but that failure actually proved something that the average person cannot build even the most basic thing in our lives anymore. Knowledge is the best weapon. God damn it, I wish I knew why. Yeah, I can see what's going on here. Okay. Knowledge is the most underestimated survival tool. You got to think, since the Dark Ages, there's been 500 years of trial and error in just about everything we use and touch and see and hear that can easily be lost because we're forgetting it. And we don't want to go through the 500 years of trial and error all over again. It's just a waste of time. So if we can learn where some of this stuff comes from, pass it on, you can kind of preserve this as this little nugget of society. Oh, why don't I have audio? There we go.
So how is that technology useful, Adam?
I mean, aside from sexual stimulation. The camera's working great, by the way. The batteries, everything.
I got more. I got another one here.
Making the lead plates is like no big deal. We can pull those out of all the cars we want. It's just topping it off with the acid. And then you get like 900 minutes on a charge. Most of San Francisco's water system, roughly 80% of the city, 80% of the peninsula is gravity fed. So we thought water would be one of the first things to go, and in fact, it's actually survived quite well. God bless city planners. I mean, it's a very serviceable system. We're putting, like I said, a tiny drain on it proportionally. That's going to last for a long time.
So check this out. This is why it's a little hard to push this damn thing. The rollers fell out inside the casing here and have been wearing against the shaft.
We humped a whole bunch of backup power lead acid batteries from the office towers downtown. There's thousands of those. They weigh about 900 pounds apiece, but it's more than sufficient to run this building. One is more than sufficient to run this building all night long, and we got four families in this building. There's enough solar panels to keep us going probably for 20 years. We've worked out a storage space for them. Christine found it last week. And as long as they're well kept, they don't deteriorate. It's just if they break, they're garbage. I think I nailed this thing. What?
It's reinvented.
So, yes, that was Adam Savage. It's from a movie called Ever Since the World Ended, and it's a pseudo-documentary, as if, you know, there was only, after some plague, there was only, like, 180 survivors left in San Francisco, and he plays the engineer guy. And he's literally having to rediscover all of these basic concepts for providing for this band of survivors. Very good movie. I would recommend it, just a thing. But Robert Heinlein said it very well. A human being should be able to change a diaper, plan an invasion, butcher a hog, con a ship, design a building, write a sonnet, balance accounts, build a wall, set a bone, comfort the dying, take orders, give orders, cooperate, act alone, solve equations, analyze a new problem, pitch manure, program a computer, cook a tasty meal, fight effectively, die gallantly. Specialization is for insects. Every person needs to have skills. I mean, we need to be able to do anything, you know, should the circumstances need it. I mean, the zombie apocalypse is coming. You know, if you read the headline, Metering Man says, stranger chewed, swallowed after taking a bite of his arm. You know, officer from District 4 reported to Beth Israel Hospital, human bite to arm, suspect in custody. If it was a zombie bite, would you tell us? Yes, absolutely. You know, the signs are everywhere that the zombie apocalypse is coming. You need to take this seriously. So, let's talk zombies here, right? And like I said, zombies are the perfect thing for this because it's a persistent disaster. It's biological. It's, you know, it's occupational, and just a hell of a lot of fun. So you survived. Now what? Is anyone else alive? Something you'd want to know. Zombies ate your cell phone. You probably don't want to go and get it back. What other information do other survivors have? What resources do others have? What resources do you have that they might need? Ham operators are always invaluable in disaster scenarios, but if you're caught unawares or unprepared or just, you know, Joe Schmuck on the street, how do you pick up these broadcasts? Minimal parts can be found and improvised, and if, you know, something as simple as the ARRL handbook, you can learn an awful lot. You know, take a class, volunteer, become a ham, learn some of this radio stuff. I was going to show a clip from Terminator Salvation, but on the advice of the EFF, I can't, because it's still in theaters, and these guys would fight that. And it's one of those things where you can't just use it and then say, oh, it's fair use. You actually have to sort that out in court. And considering I'm a foreign national, I really don't want to have to do that. So screw the MPAA. I hope the zombies get them first. So... I was actually considering, you know, posting the time code should you, you know, be able to sit there with a stopwatch in the theater or however you're watching it. Foxhole radios. Norwegian resistance used these. They're used in World War II. It's a very simple receiver built out of just scrap parts. And I hope this video works. Apologies to Bree Pettis, but hey, you made a Creative Commons.
Hello and welcome to Weekend Projects. I'm Bree Pettis, and every week I bring a project that you can make over the weekend. This week we're going to make a foxhole radio. During World War II, GIs got really clever and made up really cool radios that were super simple so they could listen to radio stations. There were German stations you could listen to, and sometimes you even got lucky and heard an English station. To make this project, you're going to need a toilet paper tube, you're going to need a safety pin, a bunch of thumbtacks, and a razor blade. Oh, and you're going to need some magnet wire and a board to put it all on, plus an antenna, which is just a long wire. I'm just going to use some wire I scrounged out of a Cat 6 cable, and you need, for the ground, I'm just going to use some of that same wire as well. All right, let's make it. For the coil, I'm using magnet wire. That's because it's got a non-conductive coating. GIs in the field would have found stuff like this in motors, or they could have just used regular wire and coated it with varnish.
tattoo with tape before you wind it up, or put a hole in it and tie it on. That'll keep it from slipping as you wind it up.
No, I'm really pressed for time, so I'm actually going to skip this. It's about 5 minutes long.
I'm trying this again.
But essentially, it's a receiver that requires no power. He shows it. He picks up like a talk radio station. I mean, try building one of these things. You find it surprisingly easy. I mean, in the Norwegian Resistance Museum, there was one that they had built out of into actually a pair of dentures that they were using in a prison. And I mean, it's just absolutely amazing that these guys were able to pick this stuff up. This is a very basic skill that has been lost. I mean, most people don't have to build their own radios anymore. Sharing of knowledge is going to be incredibly important in a real mega disaster scenario. How many of you have read Zombie Survival Guide and or World War Z? All right, a bunch of you, good. World War Z, there's a thing they talk about. It's radio-free Earth. And during the zombie apocalypse that's going on, they basically start broadcasting information as to, you know, where is safe, you know, if there's things that have changed. And it's just total just blasted out there. And it's information like, you know, how to make clean water and stuff like that, that anybody who did survive might not have or anything like that. It has a massive effect on the ability to fight back in this particular scenario. If you do learn something about radio, take the time to train others. You know, if you've got a hackerspace or something like that, just set it up so that you can have a class once in a while, build a foxhole radio, stuff like that. You have to also consider the positive psychological effects of knowing that there is somebody else out there, that there is hope. I mean, as the Prez said, you can't live a moment without hope. So let's look at agriculture quickly. And like I said, this whole thing is just sort of things I have found that I am trying to integrate into my life and trying to learn myself. So yours might differ, but food supplies are heavy. I mean, everyone always talks about canned food, but if you've got to be mobile, you're going to need to be able to set up new food supplies elsewhere. Seeds are a lot lighter. Seed banks, knowledge of how, and also the knowledge of how to use them. How many people, you know, have never grown a garden or something like that nowadays? I'm not asking you, I'm just saying in general, like, how many people in New York City have never planted something in dirt and seen it grow? You also need to be mindful of the useful plants in the area around you. You also need to be aware of things like the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which is a last-ditch storehouse for food-producing crops. Should there be some disease or something that wipes out a major crop, at least they'll have these seeds sequestered that, you know, they might be able to bring them back or do genetic research on them, whatever. A lot of people, how many of you have actually heard of it? How many of you know where it is? Very, very few. Well, if you must know, you know, there's Norway and Sweden and everything. It's way the hell up there. You know, I don't know. Open Office keeps changing a bunch of my text to dark green. It doesn't show up. Damn it. The presentation will be available later. Oh, shut up. But if there
say a word.
If there's resources like this around, you know, in a disaster situation, knowing where they are ahead of time is kind of useful because, you know, you can't Google this crap after the apocalypse. I do want to mention useful plants, and one of the most useful ones is hemp. I'm talking industrial hemp, not what – yeah, I'm not even going to say it. You can make rope, paper, foodstuffs, cloth, fuels, oils, all sorts of things out of this stuff, but you need to know how to do it. Unfortunately, various governments don't want you to learn this, but it doesn't mean you can't read anyways and figure out how to do it yourself. It's mostly because it's low maintenance and low pesticide requirements. You essentially had William Randolph Hearst back in the early 20th century had a huge amount of money invested in pulp and paper, and hemp was coming on as this great replacement for paper, and gee, he owns a bunch of newspapers that he wanted to use his assets in tree pulp. And so, massive smear campaign against marijuana and everything. So, with hemp, you can basically do multiple crops a year. So you can get a massive amount of output of product for using as a resource that, you know, a tree takes, you know, 20 years before you can cut it down. You can get like a half a dozen hemp crops out in a year. Tools that you carry with you. Everybody thinks Gordon Freeman. I want a crowbar. No, I don't want a crowbar. I want a Halligan bar. This is a picture of a Halligan bar, also known as a hooligan bar. You see these with firefighters, too, and there's also a couple of great things, like when they're trying to overturn the bus in Mythbusters. You see Adam Savage standing with one. It's a rescue bar. Literally, just Google around on like YouTube for Halligan bar, and they'll show you how to use it. It's for busting down doors and getting people out of cars and everything. The idea is that if you have multiple tools integrated into one, it's less to carry. Plus, you got to think, that nice spike on the end there, that what that's got to do with a zombie brain. So, I'm not a big fan of guns, but I'm not stupid. Again, no knowledge is bad. I'm going to be taking steps to acquire my gun license up in Canada, not because I want a weapon, but just should things be progressing in a way I feel I need one, I'm not having to go and, spend a month doing paperwork to get the damn thing. I don't know what the local laws for where you are. Look them up. Doing the paperwork is easy. Spend a couple of bucks on the license, do it. But you also have to think, ammo is heavy, limited, and if you're thinking beyond the short term, this thing's just like an airsoft gun or something, but the guy's only got like 26 rounds in there. And if you're dealing with a horde of 1,000, that's not going to go too far. So you have to start thinking tools, weapons, swords and machetes are probably going to be a hell of a lot more useful. They don't need reloading, and you can use them for other things, clearing crops, defense, whatever. Oh, dear God, I'm going to have to move fast. But you need to know how to use it. I mean, yeah, you might have a cool sword, but there's specific muscles in the arm that get developed when you do sword play that you're going to need, or else you're going to be, so tired in 10 minutes. ZombieTools.net has some absolutely awesome stuff that is custom built for zombie killing. Looks good on the wall, too. And if I can get, this is some of their stuff. And if I could get tactical corsets people up here. Fashion and function don't have to be mutually exclusive. What we have here is a tactical corset. And basically, it's a military tack vest combined with a corset. Who says you can't make your own clothing? Who says it doesn't have to, look good? Personally, most of the mil-spec gear that's out there in surplus and everything doesn't fit me. I mean, do I look like I'm military size? So I'm going to have to build my own. You can hit tacticalcorsets.com and check out more about this. But, I mean, this is just an absolutely awesome idea of something you could build ahead of time and might be useful later. So thank you very much. So they just happen to be here as well. So, okay. Blacksmithing. Building your own weapons, tools, parts. It's that self-perpetuation of technology is going to be incredibly useful. It's easy to start up, making metal hot isn't a problem, but it's really hard to master, so it's something you'd probably want to work on a bit. It's relatively easy to set up. I mean, one of the first things when we're setting up our hackerspace back home is, we've got a steam hood that was there from the factory previously. I want to use that for a blacksmithing station, so I'm looking into that. It's also fun for non-disasters, too. You can make some really awesome stuff blacksmithing, and it's a good skill to learn. Take a class. Metalworking is becoming a lost art. Everything's plastic. You combine that with some knowledge of geology, metallurgy. You can mine your own ores and everything, smelting. Because you've got to remember, the cities might not be safe for scavenging.
Must be Manchester.
Whole Manchester, whole city.
Okay, it's not quite a zombie movie, but close enough. I'm going to skip ahead, but basically the entire city of Manchester is on fire, and there's no fire crews to put it out, so you may not be able to, just go down to the Walmart and raid that for things. Brewing and distillation, I know this is something all of you are very familiar with. Turning waste biomass into, alcohols. You can brew beers, distill spirits, ferment wines. Ethanol for fuel, Molotov cocktails, disinfectants, antiseptics, cleaners, all sorts of things can be made just with brewing and distillation. And frankly, in a zombie apocalypse, I would want a drink. So this is going to be a high priority for me. Engines. modern engines aren't that easy to repair. Have you ever tried repairing, you know, a dual overhead cam, fuel-injected engine nowadays? You can't do it without a computer. Old engines are easier. I'm building a 71 Dodge Demon with a 440 in it. You can't get much more simple than a simple push rod. The Mad Max V8 Interceptor is also not that practical, because you also have to think fuel is going to be a short supply because there's no refineries running anymore. So a 2- and 4-stroke engine repair is going to be much more useful. Yes, it means you're going to be running around in Vespas, but that's a hell of a lot better use of your fuel. And also, there's all sorts of other things that would be incredibly useful to have in a zombie apocalypse. I had to. There's this whole resurgence in steampunk, but people seem to be forgetting steam power. It worked for 100 years. I mean, if you learn some blacksmithing, you can probably make your own gear for doing it. It's a simple source of power that you can use as a direct replacement for a gas engine in things like, you know, generators, pumps, heaters, refrigeration. Most anything can be steam powered, and it worked for 100 years. Why not again? Just need to learn it. Again, that self-perpetuation of technology, you build the power source that allows you to build other things and then go down the line. Useful for locomotion and defense. So this touches on chemistry.
Best movie ever.
If you know how this ends. Okay, I'm just going to go forward because I got the 5-minute thing going there. So, but essentially, we need to look at the technology of the past so we can prepare for the future. Because the technology of the past is what's going to last. You know, maybe we need to examine some of these outdated technologies, refine them, you know, add some modern twists to them, but still have that usefulness in the past. Prepare a kit with the essentials for reference. Books are going to be huge in this. And I mean, if you're educating yourself, you need to educate others. If your brain is in a zombie, it's no use. You know, this thought experiment ended up answering one of the biggest philosophy questions of the modern age. Which would you rather have, Marianne or Ginger? That is a good answer. But the answer is the professor. Think about how many things he built to make their lives easier. We need to be like the professor. Yeah, I know, he couldn't patch the hole in the boat, but you see my point, though. He also kept them sane by giving them small creature comforts. Marianne would also have been useful, you know, Kansas farm girl, familiar with, you know, which end of a nail is sharp. Very underrated on the show. Disasters are going to suck. We need to also think about the psychology, you know, things like game theory. Have a basic understanding of that so that we can keep people from, you know, trying to eat us. Rocks don't need backing up. You know, think about, as I said with Scott, you know, a hard drive with a terabyte, a huge amount of information, is incredibly fragile. You can lose that information in a heartbeat. There are, you know, 4,000-year-old stone tablets we're still reading. You know, okay, yeah, a rock beats paper, but paper beats a flimsy plastic disc. You know, a book is going to be so much more useful. Henley's 20th century formulas, look it up, but it's got formulas for everything. It was like what your housemaid would have in order to make anything and everything because you couldn't order everything from Amazon. Pocket Ref. I mean, how many? A lot of you have this. Incredibly useful. I think we need to look at more books like this where it's just jam-packed with all sorts of little tidbits of things in a small, useful thing. What I'm proposing is a crowdsourced knowledge bank, something like a wiki, where you can distill a topic down to a Twitter post or something about that size. I don't need to know the where, when, or how somebody developed something. I need to know where the rubber hits the road. What was that one eureka moment 200 years ago that led to whatever technology? I need to know what that is in a form that I can reach later. So, you know, put it in a wiki, edit it down, and then put it into a book. That's what the book you'd have in your go bag. I see it as being incredibly useful. And this gentleman here is actually wearing the shirt, but this is a poster that basically says, let's say you've gone back in time, and contains just very succinct, very short descriptions of what you need to know in order to recreate a lot of modern technologies. We need to have something like this for a larger scale. So, I'm going to be in the other room there. I plowed through an incredible amount. 104? So, thank you.